Turn, if you would, please, in your Bibles to Daniel chapter 11. Daniel chapter 11. This is one of the longer passages to work through in the book of Daniel. I say that not to scare you, but we do have our work cut out for us in the next 45 minutes. I have been praying through this passage. At the start of the book of Daniel, this was the one passage that I was not looking forward to preaching. It's very intense. As I was reading one commentator, he said when he was working to preach through this, he kept opening commentaries and said, this is good material for Bible study. This is good material for Bible workshops. This is not good material to preach. That's not what you want to read in a commentary. Fortunately, he said, because of the great buildup to this passage, all of chapter 10, the long introduction, that this is probably one of the more important passages to preach, even though it's so complicated. I'm just going to jump right into the context of where Daniel 11 falls. And as we've been working through all of the book of Daniel, we remember that the context is the Babylonian captivity. This is where we're at. We're in exile. So Daniel 1 speaks of that exile. Daniel 5 through 6 speaks of the fact that we've transitioned from Babylon as an empire to Persia as an empire. And that is where we're going to find ourselves in this chapter, Daniel chapter 11. Daniel chapter 9, God laid out a divine program, 70 weeks, with regard to Daniel's people, the Jews. Okay, so there's this future that is specific unto Judaism itself. Daniel chapter 9 then, he's anticipating this release, which comes in Ezra chapter 1. It comes in the first year of Cyrus the Mede. And we're told that the Jews are released, but as they go back to the land, after about a year, year and a half, there's no temple. Nothing's happening. And as they come to this Jewish Passover, Daniel's kind of wondering, where does this fit? Where is this going? What's happening? And so he starts to pray. And God sends an angel. He sends first, probably none other than Jesus Christ, the pre-incarnate Christ, kind of gives this vision to Daniel. Listen, I'm still in control. I'm still on the throne. And there is glory that belongs to me. And I'm doing a work that will astound you. We see then in Ezra 3 that right after this first Passover back in the land, that the temple foundation is laid, that God's program is moving forward, that God's people are getting on board and they're making advancements in this program of God. But there's going to be adversaries. You would think that they've spent their time in exile, now they get to go back and things are going to be on track, things are going to be moving forward, it's going to be bigger, better, onward, upward, but it seems like two steps forward, three steps back. And so this is the place where we find ourselves as we come to Daniel chapter 11. And so we come to this section, and you could probably have the same feeling that's expressed on this professor's face. You know, welcome to history class. And he just has this kind of morbid look. It's like, oh, wow, we get to work through names and dates and wars and rumors of wars. Woo-hoo. And it's going to be a bleak history that's going to be written here. But the one thing I want us to take away from today is this, that where the future is bleak, that's where God's glory shines bright. And that's what he's going to use light and he's going to use darkness. In fact, we're going to end up in Daniel chapter 12. Let's go down to verse 3 is where this section ends. He says there, and those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the sky above. Those who turn many to righteousness will shine like the stars forever and ever. And he uses this metaphor of shining brightness, of glory in the midst of darkness, to help us to understand that this is a very bleak future. It's a very dark future. It's a very morbid future. But where the future looks dark, God's glory shines bright. And that's kind of what Mike was saying as he went to Psalm 88. In the midst of the darkness, reading about another man's darkness, God brings light.
That's what Rob was saying, when in the midst of his darkness, that God brought these verses to mind, and it was only when life was dark that those verses jumped off the page as light, as life-breathing, light-infusing life. And that's what God's wanting to do for us in this text in particular this morning. So as we work through this, what we're going to see is that this text reveals three important truths about human history. These are things that you have to keep in mind as we look to the future. In fact, as we look at today, because these truths don't just pertain to some distant sweet by and by. They pertain to the future in which we live today. Okay, so this is going to govern all of human history. And the first is this, that human history is meticulously ordered by God. In Daniel chapter 11, verse 2, the angel is speaking to Daniel and he says, "Now I will show you the truth." He'd been given a book of truth. The word is true. And he says, "Now I'm going to make sure that you understand this truth. Now I will show you the truth." And then he starts to lay out history. "Behold, three more kings shall arise in Persia." So we're under king number one. There's going to be king number two, king number three, king number four. "And a fourth shall be far richer than all of them. And when he has become strong through his riches, he shall stir up all against the kingdom of Greece." And we're going to find that as we work through this section, that there's going to be two major sections. Verse 2 down through verse 20 is going to cover about 355 years in 19 verses. It's going to cover all the way from 530 BC to 175 BC, 350 years. Then we're going to put on the brakes and we're going to go in slow motion. And we're going to cover 12 years in the next 15 verses. So we cover 350 years in 19 verses, then we cover 12 in 15. Something's going on here and it's going on purpose. Listen to a couple commentators, what they say about this. Joe Sprinkle says, "This unit constitutes some of the most remarkable fulfillment of prophecy in the Bible." Stephen Miller says, "The historical details set forth in this prophecy are astounding." Okay, so maybe this is worth reading. Campbell says, "In the first 35 verses of this chapter, there are at least 135 prophecies that have been fulfilled." 35 verses, 135 prophecies that have been fulfilled and can be corroborated by a study of the history of the period. This is so exact as to how history has happened that this chapter in particular is the reason that most secular scholars say this can't be prophecy, because you can't tell the future with this kind of accuracy. This has to be written after these things happened because it's so accurate in its smallest details. We know that this isn't true. We know that this was written beforehand, and these things have come to place just as God said. I want you to understand that God's glory shines brightest when the future is the darkest, right? But I also want you to understand that if God kept his word about the stupid details of a queen promised to a king and it didn't work out right, that he can promise something like Jesus is coming to win the war at the end of the world, and he's going to keep that promise. If God keeps the small promises, God's not going to blow off the big promises. Be encouraged with that this morning. So we're going to see the fact that there's two major sections where we cover a whole lot of ground in a little bit of time, then we cover a whole little ground in a whole lot of time. So let's work through the providence as God transitions kingdoms across history. He's talking about a great conflict. You're in chapter 11, go back to chapter 10, because chapters 10 through 12 are all one chunk. Chapter 10, verse 1, "This comes in the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia. This word is revealed to Daniel," whose name was Belteshazzar because he's in exile. It's a word that's true, and it's a word that concerns a great conflict. And we saw in chapter 10 what that looks like. It looks like angels and demons fighting behind the scenes as nations are playing on the chessboard of creation, and something's happened behind and something's happening in front. And there's a conflict in which all of creation is engaged. The things you can see and the things you can't see are all functioning in this great conflict. But what we need to be absolutely convinced of in these first 35 verses is that God is in control. These are transitions that are happening, and we're watching it, as it were, on the drama or on the stage of human history. But we're only seeing one move at a time. But there's a mind that's moving all the pieces. He's coordinating all of the things through wills that are free, and yet he's in control. He's sovereign of all that's happening as we work through this. So let's see what's happening here. Verse 2. It says, when this fourth king becomes strong through his riches, he shall stir up all against the kingdom of Greece. So this is Xerxes. This is Esther's husband, who's very rich. He's going to stir up his entire kingdom against Greece. It's spelled out right there at the end of verse 2. Verse 3, then a mighty king shall arise. We just jumped over 100 years. Then a mighty king shall arise in Greece, who shall rule with great dominion, and he will do as he wills. But as soon as he has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken and divided to the four winds of heaven. We know that's exactly what happened with the kingdom of Alexander the Great. He conquers everything. He comes from Greece. He conquers part of Egypt. He swings over. He conquers Babylon. He conquers Persia all the way up to the Indus River, all the way to India. Alexander the Great. Probably nobody had the military prowess and success of this young man who died by the age of 32, conquered the world in 10 years. I play the board game Risk, and it takes me longer than that to win, right? Okay. So after he dies, four generals inherit his throne. Not his kids, his four generals, Seleucus, Ptolemy, Antigonus, and Cassander. There's a fifth, Lysimachus, his bodyguard, and he's going to come into play here in just a minute. Let's see how this kind of plays out. So it says down in verse 5, then the king of the south shall be strong. So Ptolemy, when we're talking north and south in this passage, keep this in mind. Jerusalem right here, okay, this is the promised land. So everything is in relation to the land of God's people. Keep that in mind. So when we're talking south, we're talking Egypt. When we're talking north, we're talking the Seleucid dynasty right up here. So verse 5, the king of the south shall be strong, but one of his princes shall be stronger than he and shall rule, and his authority shall be great. Okay, so what happens is Antigonus decides to go against Seleucus. Well, Seleucus, who's not this great military general, he's just kind of a mediocre military general, he runs down and finds shelter with his buddy Ptolemy. And so he's going to go down to Egypt for a bit. Well, in the meantime, Cassander and Lysimachus don't really like the proud Antigonus in their corner of the world. So they're going to decide they're going to go against him. And Seleucus says, hey, this is my opportunity. I'm going to get back at the guy who is trying to get me. So they go against Antigonus and they win. They wipe out Antigonus. Lysimachus and Cassander, they kind of like it over in their corner of the world. They say, Seleucus, why don't you go ahead and take back control of your empire, and you can have most of Antigonus' empire too. We don't want it. You got that. So this Seleucid general was actually serving under Ptolemy in the south, but now he gains authority, and he gains more authority than this proud, great Ptolemaic general down south. Okay, this really happened. This is how things worked. Verse 6, after some years, like 50, they shall make an alliance. Who's they? Well, we've been talking about the king of the north and the king of the south. And the daughter of the king of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement, but she shall not retain the strength of her arm, and his arm shall not endure, but she shall be given up in her attendants, and he who fathered her, and he who supported her in those times. That's really great. Thus says the word of the Lord. Be blessed. Let's go home, right? What are we talking about? Well, as this map kind of points out, we're talking about some territory that's going to be repeatedly contested between the Seleucid king and the Ptolemaic king. It's this land of property right here in between. Just happens to be Israel, Palestine. Is it really that much of a question mark in our minds that they're fighting over the belly button of the world? This is where the whole thing holds together. Europe, Africa, over into Asia. It's all held together by this one strip of land. And it becomes a rather important piece of land that everybody wants. What's going to happen is that we're going to have several different wars. In fact, we're going to have, over the course of these next several years, five different wars between these guys. Egypt is going to come up and they're going to invade the capital city of the Seleucid dynasty. It's right here on the sea. Seleucia on the sea, just in from it is Antioch. If you'll note later on, we have Antiochus Epiphanes. Okay, all the Antiochuses are named Antiochus because they come from Antioch. That's where they reign, the king from Antioch. So what happens is the king of the south is going to make an agreement with the king of the north. He's going to send up his daughter to be married and will unite the kingdoms. This is the way history has always worked, right? The only problem is, king of the north is already married. He says, no problem, I'll divorce this wife, and my new wife and I will have children, and they will reign, and we will be one. For some reason, wife number one doesn't think that's a great idea. Okay? She ends up poisoning her husband and killing his new wife and their son. Go figure. So that's why it says there in verse 6, but she shall not retain the strength of her arm. It kind of goes away when you're dead. Verse 7. So from a branch from her roots, one shall arise in his place. In whose place? Well, her father's place, who sent her up from Egypt. It says at the end of verse 6, he who fathered her, he will be given up as well. He dies in this whole mess up. He's gone. So one from her roots, that is her brother, will rise up in his place and shall come against the army and enter the fortress of the king of the north. And he shall deal with them and he shall prevail. So her brother, I think it's Ptolemy the Third, who ends up coming up north, he says, hey, you can't poison my sister. I'm going to kill you. And he does. And then he moves up further and he moves into some of the capital cities and he takes back the wealth that during the Persian Empire, Cambyses had taken away from Egypt. And so he grabs the Egyptian plunder and brings it back to Egypt. And they say, this guy is great. Long live the king. We have a new hero in history. Ptolemy the Third. And so verse 8, he shall also carry off to Egypt their gods, their metal images, their precious vessels of silver and gold. And for some years he shall refrain from attacking the king of the north. Well, then the latter, the king of the north, shall come into the realm of the king of the south, but he's going to turn around and go right back again. He's not going to do much. And that's exactly what happens. The Seleucid king doesn't do much. We move a little bit farther. We come into the Syrian wars, more Syrian wars, more Syrian wars. Verse 10, the king of the north, sons shall wage war, assemble a great multitude. They'll keep coming and overflow and pass through, and again shall carry the war as far as his fortress. Then the king of the south, moved with rage, shall come out and fight against the king of the north, and the north shall raise a great multitude, but it will be given into the hand of the south. Okay, again, this is just history, but a lot of stuff is happening. This is happening 100, 200 years after it's actually given to Daniel. And there's a whole lot of history that's happening here. And we could work through and we could explain which king is doing what and who's doing all of these things. But what I want to get at is what's taking place on the big picture here. When we come down to about 202 to 195 BC. Remember, we're working backwards because we're before zero. We're going to see that eventually some of this Seleucid Empire starts to be taken away. Parthia takes some. They're going to lose some to the Parthians little by little by little. And you see there that they're starting to take over. But there's one other person that's going to come on the scene, and that is the Roman Empire. So go down to verse 14. In those times many shall rise against the king of the south, and the violent among your own people, Daniel, will lift themselves up in order to fulfill the vision. But they're going to fail. The king of the north shall come and throw up siege works and take a well-fortified city, and the forces of the south shall not stand, or even his best troops. There will be no strength to stand, but he who comes against the king of the south will do as he wills, and none will stand before him. So we've had back and forth and back and forth for years, from 274 down to 195, almost 200 years. There's been back and forth banter over this piece of property. But in verse 16, we're told that the king of the north wins and there's no going back. At this point, there's no more south is going to contend for this property. So, we're going to see that things are going to happen. He's going to turn, verse 18, afterwards, he shall turn and face the coastlands, and he's going to capture many of them, but a commander shall put an end to his insolence. Indeed, he shall turn his insolence back upon him. So this Roman Empire, after the king of the north takes care of the king of the south, he's going to turn and he's going to start taking some of these islands and these coastlands up here. Well, guess what? The Roman Empire that's moved into Greece at this point says, far enough. This is Antiochus III. He's coming with an army of some 70,000 troops. He comes up against 30,000 Romans. He says, I want that. They said, over my dead body. And 30,000 Romans annihilate the troops of Antiochus, and he goes home with his tail between his legs. He's given a huge debt that he has to pay back. He has to pay for their war. He has to leave behind some 20 hostages. One of them is his own son, Antiochus IV. He's the second born, so he's not necessarily the one who's going to be on the throne. Antiochus IV goes off to Europe. He's held hostage for many years. But this is embarrassing on the global stage at this point. We come down to verse 20. Antiochus leaves. Then one shall arise in his place who shall send an exactor of tribute for the glory of the kingdom. But within a few days he shall be broken, neither in battle nor in anger. So Antiochus ends up dying because he has this huge debt to pay. He robs the temple of his own people. They say, nope. Not going to work. They kill him. He's dead. So another one comes up in his place. He says, I've still got this debt to pay. So he hires this one to go collect the tribute, collect the taxes so he can pay for this war. And he finds resistance everywhere he goes. So he turns around and he poisons the king. So it ends up that the king dies not in battle, not by a mob, just poisoned by his tax collector. Verse 21. So in his place shall arise a contemptible person, one to whom royal majesty has not been given. He'll come in without warning or in a time of peace to kind of slither in there, and he'll obtain the kingdom by flatteries. But he'll work in such a way that he'll have victories militarily. Verse 22, armies shall be utterly swept away before him and broken, including a prince with whom he makes covenant. And from the time that an alliance is made with this prince, this king will act deceitfully. He'll become strong with just a small people. And without warning, he's going to move into the richest parts of the province and do what neither his fathers nor his father's fathers had done, scattering among them plunder, spoil, and goods. And he'll devise plans against strongholds, but he'll only do this for a time. What he's going to do is he's going to make plans to come down into Egypt. And he's going to do what no king had done before him. He's actually going to not just beat them up, but he's going to take their property. He's going to bring it back home. He's doing this because he's paying off his own army a year in advance. And so he's working in a time of peace. There's no wars, but he's paying his troops ahead, buying their loyalty. And so now he's creating his own debt. He's got to pay for it somewhere. Raids Egypt, pulls the plunder back to his own, and he keeps moving forward this way. This is Antiochus IV, the one that was sent to Rome as a hostage. He's been released. His younger nephew has been sent, one who's in line to the throne. And what Grand Antiochus does is he ends up marrying his brother's widow, the brother who was the king. So when you marry the queen, what do you become? You become the king. And in his graciousness, he decides to adopt her children. And once they're under his care, they're poisoned, and somehow they just don't make it to the throne. So he ends up being king. He's worked his way in there. He slithered in there in a time of peace, made some alliances. The guy's a sneaky jerk is what he is. But he gains some military victories. But it says, he shall devise plans against the south, verse 24, but only for a time. And then he's going to make alliance with the king of the south. Let's see, let's go down to verse 27. As for the two kings, the kings that are making an alliance, we met them earlier, the kings that are going to make an alliance, as for these two kings, their hearts shall be bent on doing evil. They'll speak lies at the same table, but to no avail, for the end is yet to be at the time appointed. He'll return to his land with great wealth, but his heart shall be set against the holy covenant, and he shall work his will and return to his land. So we've come to Antiochus Epiphanes, and this guy is a jerk. He's a bum. But why do we slow down when we come to Antiochus Epiphanes? I mean, we're talking from verse 21 all the way down to verse 35, 12 years in 15 verses. What's so important about this guy? God has brought us through most of chapter 11, telling us the background, giving us a historical prelude, if you will, for the important piece of the puzzle. And the important part of the puzzle is this: God's people. How does this affect God's people? Because those are the people that are affected right here. And as we're moving back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, God's people are involved in this process. And what's going to happen is this Antiochus Epiphanes, he's coming back from the south. It says, he shall return, verse 28, with great wealth, but his heart shall be set against the holy covenant. That's the covenant of God against the people of God. As he's moving back north, he finds that there's political unrest. As he was moving through, one of the wealthier of the Judeans had come up to him and said, hey, can I buy the priesthood? I'll give you extra money if I can be the high priest. He says, hey, that's a great idea. I'm in need of money. So, yeah, why don't you take the high priesthood? Well, good Jews don't like that, okay? They don't like the politics of a guy buying the high priesthood. So as he's gone down, he's got more money, he's coming back through, there's unrest. He deals with it the only way a military commander knows how to deal with it. 80,000 people later, he says, now, who will give me the highest price to be high priest? Okay, go. You win. 80,000 people die. Boom. This guy isn't just a jerk. He's vicious. So he's angered. Now, verse 29. At the time appointed, at God's time, Antiochus Epiphanes is going to return and come again to the south. But this time, it's not going to be like it was before. Because, verse 30, the ships of Kittim or Cyprus shall come against him. Cyprus, right up here in the Mediterranean Sea, is a league of Rome and Cyprus and Greece. And they're all coming together. And the story goes that the Roman commander came to Antiochus as he's coming to invade Egypt. And he says, listen, you have two choices. You can either leave and we'll be friends, or you can continue your party here, fighting against these Egyptians, at which point you become not only their enemy, but our enemy as well. And the commander takes a stick and he draws a circle around Antiochus in the sand. He says, now make up your mind before you leave that circle, because we want to know. He decides, you know what? I've been a prisoner of Rome. I know what they do. I know how they operate. I'm not going there. So he leaves. But look how he leaves. Verse 30. Ships of Kittim shall come against him, and he shall be afraid and withdraw. And he shall turn back and be in a bad mood. You think? He shall be enraged. And where is he going to let that rage find action? He will take action against the Holy Covenant. He's going to take action on God's people. He'll turn back and pay attention to those who forsake the Holy Covenant. He'll pay attention to those who don't want to be good Jews. Verse 31, forces from him shall appear, and they'll profane the temple and the fortress. They'll take away the regular burnt offering. They'll set up the abomination that makes desolate, and he shall seduce with flattery those who violate the covenant. We're moving into why this history matters. Because not only is human history meticulously ordered by God, we're talking marriages, we're talking alliances, we're talking lies, we're talking deception, and there's so much that we could go into. But as we get to this point in the story, what we're going to find is that human history means real trouble for God's people. Because as these individuals begin to do what they want to do, they accomplish their own will, and they do it by their own strength. What we see is that God's people get caught in the crosshairs. And so, he's starting to turn people away from God, away from God's covenant. He wants to establish the Greek culture, so he sets up gymnasiums. He takes the temple, and he sets up an altar to Zeus. And what we're going to see in this section is that we're reaching a climax in this great conflict. Because there's a conflict between those who love God, those who don't love God, those who are working for God, those who are working against God. And what we see is that God's people are going to suffer, and they're going to suffer greatly. And so as Antiochus moves in, he starts to attack nothing less than the temple of God itself. And so he goes against the temple, and he sets up a statue of Zeus right there in the temple, an abomination that makes the temple dirty and filthy. He sets up prostitution there in the temple courtyards. I mean, he's taking everything that's holy and just making it filthy and licentious. And he says, this is how you be a good Greek. Don't bother being a good Jew. Let's learn how to be a good Greek. He sets up these gymnasiums where they do everything in the nude. They're naked. And he just takes away all the decency of their culture, and he's trying to set up a totally different kind of culture. What's happening is that God's people are in the crosshairs. And in order to be a good citizen of planet Earth, you have to let go of the one God who is true and just fit into the God of the day, the God du jour, the God of the people with whom you find yourself. And so we see back up in verse 32, right in the middle of the verse, he'll seduce with flattery those who violate the covenant, but the people who know their God shall stand firm. They'll take action. So it was in 169 BC that he kills 80,000 people. It's in 167 BC that he sets up this statue in the temple. But within 3 years, in 164 BC, the Maccabean revolt fights in such a unique way because they're aided by God. The military victories that they gain, they're few in number, but they outflank and outsmart these military leaders who know everything about manipulation and deception and destruction. And yet God gives victory to a couple individuals who are courageous and who are willing to die for their faith. And in the course of 3 years, that temple is purged, the statue's removed, and they go in and they find some oil. Oil that was for the lamp in the tabernacle. They found 1 day's worth of oil. It would take them 8 days in order for them to make a new batch of priestly, holy oil. So they said, let's burn it and let's just see how long it goes. And it burned for that first day. And they're working to recreate that oil. Second day, they get a second day out of that one flask of oil. It was supposed to last about a day. It lasted 2 days, 3 days, 4 days, 5 days, 6 days, 7 days. And finally on that eighth day, it begins to flicker as they pour in the new oil. And that lamp keeps lit because God had said, do not let my lamp go out. a miracle. This is when Hanukkah is set up. The rededication of the temple. The cleansing, the purging of the temple. And this is the work that God does. And what we find is that as this enemy comes, that God's people suffer. And spiritually, it's believers. They're the people who know their God and they're wise. It has the idea of having a personal relationship with this God that affects the way they live. And so he says, these are the people that are going to be caught in the crosshairs. Ethnically, he's talking about Jews. He says, Daniel, I'm talking about your people. Physically, they're going to stumble. Way back up there in verse 33, he says, some days they shall stumble by sword, by flame, by captivity, by plunder. And they're going to win, but at a great cost. They're going to get a little bit of help. They get some help from Rome. They get some help from Egypt. They get some help from some of the locals there. It says, end of verse 34, many shall join them with flattery. Some of the wise shall stumble, but look at what happens in their stumbling. They will stumble with a purpose, so that they may be refined. They'll stumble so that they may be purified. They'll stumble so that they may be made white until the time of the end. Daniel, I'm telling you, I'm bringing you down course of history. All these intriguing things are going to happen. Your people are going to be caught in the crosshairs, but some people who know your God will stand up. They'll take action. It's going to cost them their lives. But even the cost of their life isn't going to be without purpose. It's going to purify them. It's going to refine them. It's going to make them stronger in fiber. It's going to make them prove what righteousness is. It's going to make them white. They're going to reflect the glory of their God. It has a purpose. Then he's going to shift in verse 36. And at verse 36, it seems that something happens different because all of a sudden the history doesn't follow Antiochus Epiphanes anymore. He dies in Persia as a madman. This is going to say that this one is going to die up in verse 45 between the sea and the glorious mountain. He's going to die up like on the valley of Megiddo, like in army at Armageddon. That's where this guy is going to die. We've just been introduced in 35 to the time of the end. And in this end time, a king will come, and verse 40, at the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him. We're in the end times. We're at the end of the story, so we're at an end time king. But the things that were prominent as we worked through the first part of the history, the deception, the flattery, the manipulation, the autonomy, the destruction, these things are going to be writ large a little bit bigger in the story. Because we're going to move from Antiochus Epiphanes, and this king, again, will do as he wills. Now listen to what this king will do. Verse 36, he shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god. He'll speak astonishing things against the God of gods. There's only one of those. He'll prosper until the indignation or the wrath of God is accomplished. For what is decreed will be done. God says, this must happen. It's not happening willy-nilly. It's not happening by his choice. It's happening by my choice. Verse 37, he'll pay no attention to the gods of his fathers or to the one beloved of women. We don't know what that means. There's different possibilities. We'll leave it at that. We don't know what it means. He shall not pay attention to any other god. He shall magnify himself above all, including all gods. He shall honor the gods of fortresses instead of these, a god whom his fathers did not know. He shall honor, verse 39, he shall deal with the strongest fortress with the help of a foreign god. He's putting himself above all gods, and yet it seems that he's aided supernaturally. We know who this is. We know how this happens. This is the man of lawlessness, 2 Thessalonians 2. This is the Antichrist, 1 John chapter 2. This is the beast of Revelation chapter 13, who's put in place by Satan. Okay, now, verse 40, there's going to be some attacks against him. King of the south, king of the north, they're going to come with chariots and horsemen and ships. He'll come into countries and overflow and pass through. He's going to gain victories. He'll come into the glorious land. Tens of thousands will fall. But even as he's taking over in the glorious land, look at something. But, verse 41, these shall be delivered out of his hand. Edom, Moab, Ammonites, the wilderness. Oh, wait a minute. What does Revelation 13 say? Revelation 12. That the woman shall flee to the wilderness where God has prepared a place for his people to avoid the wrath of the Antichrist. Verse 42, he'll stretch out his hand to other countries, Egypt. He'll take the treasures of gold from the Libyans, the Cushites. Verse 44, news from the east and the north shall alarm him. He'll go in great fury to destroy and devote to destruction. He'll pitch his tent between the sea and the glorious mountain. But he shall come to his end with none to help him. And that's it. It doesn't explain how, it doesn't explain why. We get that at other places in the story. It's just six words in Hebrew, and he died. He's gone. He's done. Chapter 12, verse 1. At that time, in the midst of this crisis and conflict, Michael will arise, the great prince who has charge of your people. We saw him earlier in chapter 10. And there shall be a time of trouble such as has never been since there was a nation until that time. But at that time, with the aid of Michael your prince, your people, Daniel, will be delivered. Even though tens of thousands will fall, your people will be delivered, everyone whose name shall be found written in the book. And so, we see that God is in control of history. God's people will suffer through history. But we also see that human history determines eternal destiny. What you do now determines what happens to you later. Chapter 12, verse 2. And the many, it says many, but it has the idea of the many, the multitude of the dead, the multitude of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake. Some will awake to everlasting life. Some will awake to shame and everlasting contempt. And he doesn't dwell on that second category. There's only two options. When you die, you either die unto everlasting life or unto everlasting contempt. Those are the only two options. Based on what you believed, what you pursued in this life, were you a God-fearer? Did you accept Jesus Christ as your Savior? Did you take this truth and live as though this were true? Now he's going to talk about those who did that. Verse 3. Then those who are wise, those who let their life be affected by truth, shall shine like the brightness of the sky, and those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever. We come to this part. And he says, listen, this is how you should feel about this. There's a resolution to this great conflict. Because in the end, though God's people suffer, God's people win. God's people win. It might cost you your life. It's okay. You get eternal life. You're losing nothing and gaining everything. If you choose to deny the Holy Covenant, if you choose to walk away from God's Word, from God's plan, from God's program, from God's people, it will preserve your life in the present, but you forfeit it in the future. But if you're willing to walk, trusting God, on your knees, by faith, in obedience, he says, my friend, you might lose everything and yet lose nothing, because in the end, God's people win. And so he says in verse 4, Daniel, shut up the words and seal this book until the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge will increase. There'll be great travel. We'll gain more knowledge before these times come. But Daniel, seal it up, not as in hide it, but seal it up as in secure it. Let everybody know that this is true forever. This is how it always works. God is always in control of history. God's people are always hurt in the midst of history and are forced to walk by faith. But when they do, God's people will win. There might be a Maccabean revolt, or you might be crushed by an elephant, as one of the Maccabean brothers was in the midst of the revolt. But either way, you win, because you gain eternal life. My friend, in front of us, there's some dark times, but God's glory is shining in the midst of these times. So what are the take-home points in this? First is this: no amount of deception and manipulation can secure your future. Don't walk by sight. Walk by faith. Number two, no amount of flattery and gifts can buy you real friends. You don't have enough money to buy that kind of a friend. And even if you do, they won't stay loyal to you. Number three, no amount of devising and planning makes you truly wise. Only this gives wisdom. Only truth. And when you walk by this, you have wisdom. Number four, no amount of power and prestige can keep one from experiencing death. Even the most powerful man in the history of the world, the Antichrist himself, will fall suddenly. These are general truths that are for everybody. There's two more truths that are just for believers. No amount of faithfulness and courage can protect you from physical danger. Listen, you might love God, you might know God, and do great things for God, but it may still cost you your life. Keep your eyes on the cross. It cost Jesus his life. And he says, if they did this to me, guess what they'll do to you? Faithfulness and courage doesn't mean protection from physical danger, but no amount of pain or loss can keep you from receiving your eternal reward. Death doesn't end your story, because your story isn't about you, it's about him. And his glory is at stake in giving you a reward for walking by faith in him. So the future is bleak. And where that future is bleak, God's glory shines bright. In fact, we move to the darkest part of entire history, where the future is bleakest. God's glory shines brightest. God doesn't forget his people, including the Jews, who end up crucifying their Messiah, and God gives them what they want, an Antichrist. But at that moment, they will turn to faith in Jesus Christ. And Revelation chapter 7 says, 12,000 from the tribe of Gad, 12,000 from Asher, 12,000 from Judah, 12,000 from Reuben, 12,000 from Simeon. They're all going to come, and they're going to place their faith in Jesus Christ as Savior. Be careful what you pursue, because God may give you your fill of it. But hold on to Jesus, the author and finisher of your faith.